Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, I'm going to talk with Fernando Faura. He's in his 80s. And as a young reporter in Los Angeles, he investigated the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy that occurred back in 1968. And while he doesn't point fingers or draw clear conclusions, his reporting shows that there was a conspiracy, that Sirhan Sirhan did not act alone, and that there was a mysterious woman in a polka dot dress who appeared to be able to trigger a hypnotic reaction from Sirhan and cause him to pull the trigger of his gun. And the account is written newspaper reporter style, one dispatch at a time. The book is called The Polka Dot File on the Robert F. Kennedy Killing. And I must credit two sisters who are subscribers and regular listeners to this podcast who have influenced my recent interviews. And in a moment, you'll hear me credit Kat McGuire, but it was actually her sister Colleen who responded to my interview a month ago with Larry Tai, the Boston Globe reporter, who wrote a lovely bio of Robert Kennedy. But he didn't touch the details of the assassination at all. And so Colleen wrote that I should check out this book, The Polka Dot File, and I did. She also recently suggested that I pursue a book called Revolution's End, The Patty Hearst Kidnapping by Brad Schreiber, and I took her suggestion on that too. So Colleen, thank you for a couple of great ideas, and let me make you and Colleen the poster gals for subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. If you are not currently a subscriber, come on over. Just drop in at peterbcollins.com. You click menu, then become a subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page. And in minutes, you can express your support in the way that really matters by helping me cover the costs and keeping this podcast going. So thanks to Kat and Colleen. And here comes my conversation with Fernando Faura.
I shouted out, who killed the Kennedys?
Did you and me kill the Kennedys? Questions linger 48 years after the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy in Los Angeles in June of 1968. And just about a month ago, I interviewed Larry Tai, the former Boston Globe reporter who's written a powerful biography of Bobby Kennedy, and it illuminated many issues for me about Kennedy's transition from a kind of hardline anti-communist to an anti-Vietnam War activist, and he was challenging the Johnson administration and the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover on many fronts. And Larry Tai's book painted a great portrait of Robert F. Kennedy, but he devoted less than two paragraphs to the assassination at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. And I was troubled by that because I think there are significant issues about the assassination of Kennedy, whether Sirhan Sirhan acted alone, and whether or not the government, including the FBI and the Los Angeles Police Department, ran a very aggressive cover-up instead of a very aggressive investigation. And I want to thank a listener. I think it was Kat McGuire, but forgive me. I got an email after the Larry Tai interview and said, Peter, you've got to look at the polka dot file, and you've got to interview Fernando Faura. And I listened to my listeners, so I got a copy of the book. It's published by Trine Day, the courageous, scrappy publisher that also brought us H.P. Alborelli's book called A Terrible Mistake, and a number of other powerful books have come from Trine Day. Fernando Faura, thanks for joining me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
My pleasure.
Now, you have a very interesting background. You're bicultural, bilingual. You worked in the Los Angeles media market for a number of years, notably for the Hollywood Citizen's News. You took a break from that work to be an advance man and press director for Hubert Humphrey during the 1968 campaign, and then you went back to work as a reporter. So you have a lot of insights, and you've written a book that is very much in the style of a newspaper reporter. It is a series of crisp dispatches where you refer to yourself in the third person, and it details your parallel investigation into the assassination of Bobby Kennedy.
Yes. May I make one correction?
Please.
My investigation was not parallel. My investigation was ahead of theirs. Just a little needle there. My investigation was ahead of theirs, and that's the reason why Life magazine called me to see if we could join forces and do the investigation, for which I said, after consulting with my publisher, I said, of course.
Mm-hmm. And let's remind people, because, Fernando, you and I were adults at the time that this occurred, but many of our younger listeners don't know too much about the context of these events, and in particular, what was going on regarding the COINTELPRO operation. Bobby Kennedy had many enemies, including the mob and Jimmy Hoffa, people who he had been very actively chasing when he was the U.S. Attorney General during his brother's administration. So there are many, many factors involved here, and I certainly accept your correction that you ran the independent investigation that looked at all factors and tried to figure out who was with Sirhan Sirhan. Did he act alone? Was he under some sort of hypnotic spell at the time that he pulled a pistol and reportedly shot and killed Bobby Kennedy? So many questions linger, and a lot of books have been written about this, but I've never seen one that has this very personal and objective account that narrates the events of that time. So I thank you. Why did you decide to publish this book now?
You know, that is the most interesting part of this whole event is that part. I'll tell you why that happened. At the time that the events were happening in 1968, it was a time of revolution in this country. The young people were out on the street. The Vietnam was going on. The war was going on. 500,000 people. I saw 500,000 people personally in New York City at Temple Park protesting the war. It was a time of revolution in here. And the atmosphere was pretty fluid. And when I heard of the shooting and I ran there and I got involved in the investigation and so forth and so on, I did it. But I quit totally and completely because I had a life to live, and I was chasing a woman, a mystery woman, who I didn't have the resources to chase. My newspaper, the Hollywood Citizen News, which was the oldest in Los Angeles, the second oldest in Los Angeles, just was a small newspaper. It wasn't a major paper like Los Angeles Times.
Right.
And so they just didn't have the resources for it. And so that's the reason why I welcomed Life magazine entry into the investigation with me. Now, when Jordan Bonfante, who was the bureau chief at the time, and I joined forces and started chasing this one, mainly with my information, because they really had no new information. I was the one with the information because of the main witness, John Fahey. Now, after we start the investigation, and we're making progress, Jordan Bonfante and myself were going to Taipei and Guam chasing this woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because she said that she had to get out of the country, and that's the direction she was headed. Now, we had plans to go there, and when I came to Jordan's office to see how we were advancing in the process, he said, the investigation is finished. I said, why? What do you mean finished? You haven't even started. And he says, New York wants it killed. We cannot continue. So you cannot continue? And I said, I got very angry. And he said, look, Fernando, I'm only the bureau chief. I don't own Life magazine. And I said, okay, fine. Now, at that time, Life magazine had a top team of investigators investigating the mafia and everything they were doing in the country, including the thefts in the airports and so forth and so on. And they used to call that group the Skunk Works. Mm-hmm. This group of journalists, which were top-line journalists, their activities were kept secret because of the nature of the work and the mafia, and they were going really deep into the politics of the mafia and so forth. These people's work was secret, and so even their expenses were kept secret by the magazine. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of group that it was. So I told him, I asked Bonfanti, I said, please, you know, use your contacts on these conquests and see if you can find out why they're killing this. Mm-hmm. If you can find out anything.
Let me point out, Fernando, that Life and Time magazine, they were the two most powerful media outlets, if you will, in the print media at that time. And Time magazine wrote stories for people who read, and Life magazine published stories for people who looked at a lot of pictures. There were, you know, fewer words in Life magazine, but still Life took on what appeared to be hard-hitting investigations, along with lifestyle and, you know, feature stories, if you will. So it the combination of the two, they were owned by Henry Luce and the Time Life Empire, and they were very powerful players, but they also were aligned with the government. As we look back now, we can see that Henry Luce was an ally of elected leaders of both parties, and was often, you know, pushing a pretty aggressive pro-American and militarist agenda. And so to hear that Life magazine's editors ordered Bonfanti to stand down and to stop investigating, in hindsight, is not that surprising, but it probably was very shocking to you at the time.
Oh, absolutely. I must confess that at the time, you know, I was 39 years old, and I was kind of streetwise because, you know, I was educated in New York City, Puerto Rico, San Juan, Los Angeles, and I was a newsman. So, you know, I was a fairly streetwise individual. However, in my mind and in my heart, I was a pretty clean individual. You know, I'm trying to do what is right. I'm trying to do a good job. And I move on, you know, with those things. And I, like everybody else, dislike crooked politicians and bureaucrats. And we knew they were there. But I myself at that time, had no idea to what degree and to what depth, you know, this corruption existed in this country. So when they said that, when they said, look, and I said, why did they want to stop? They said, national security reasons. And I said, come on, Jordan. National security reasons, the same excuse they've used all the time with everything. He says, well, that's what they said, and that's it. That's all I could find out. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of that. And at that point, I stopped. And my newspaper, I left the newspaper. They sold it to a Colorado outfit of some, which was backed by some gangsters, which all they wanted was got in the newspaper. And I said so in the newspaper, and I got fired. You're not supposed to talk against your boss, even if he's a gangster.
Yeah.
So the investigation was killed and so forth. And I thought, well, if I can do this for all of these other people, I can do it for myself. So I went into business, did a little research, and succeeded in becoming very rich in real estate. Doesn't mean I'm rich now. I'm actually very poor. I'm back in the poor fold.
I'm sorry to hear that.
After the collapse of the economy. All my money was in real estate, so it just collapsed. And I'm back in the line. Mm-hmm. But anyway, to tell you why I chose this, I quit, and I figured I got four children. I'm being followed home. I'm being every single night, and they followed me right up to my doorstep. My sources in the district attorney's office and in the attorney general's office and the LAPD Metro, every source I had told me their own agency had my phone surveilled. Mm-hmm. And I understand, you know, that's their business. But, you know, it should not be, but that's their business. They should know what they're doing. In any case, I figure who needs it, you know, so I just left it. Forgot about it. 40 years later, I'm in Miami. I had moved to Miami because I had a project in Mexico and it was closer. And I'm going through the internet and I see a story about Sirhan Sirhan claiming that he was a Manchurian candidate, using those words, Manchurian candidate, for the first time by his lawyer. Mm-hmm. Then I read his story. And, of course, I knew this all along because the various people that called this a Manchurian candidate were Turner, Bill Turner, and Christian. And I was working very closely with Christian and Turner at the time. We were cooperating. I was giving him all the information I got. And, you know, as I found out, we got together once a week. And so they had suspected from the beginning that Sirhan was a Manchurian candidate. Now, for your audience, in case they don't know what a Manchurian candidate is, a Manchurian candidate is a person that commits a crime under hypnosis. Mm-hmm. And the source is a very famous book and movie. The movie's been made twice.
Yes, it has.
In this country, mm-hmm. called The Manchurian Candidate. All right, so they call him a Manchurian candidate, and I frankly wasn't buying into it. And I've always been very independent, so I just kept my investigation independent of theirs, and I kept moving on by myself. And so when I see this, and I'm reading this story about Sirhan claiming this, when you surf in the internet, you see other stories on a column on the right-hand side of other videos in which they tell you, if you like that video, maybe you'll like this one.
Right.
And in doing that, I saw a story about the Nixon attempts to scuttle the Paris peace talks. Mm-hmm. So I went there, and I started listening to that. And I knew about this attempt to scuttle the Paris peace talks. There have been a couple of books written about it. It's history.
Mm-hmm. And they haven't paid
much attention to it here.
In this country,
it's history, but they're not paying attention to it.
And let me just add that this relates to a connection between a Nixon supporter, Anna Chenault, and alleged contacts that she made with the ambassador of South Vietnam, including an intercepted phone call shortly before the 68 election, where she said, the boss says, hang on, we're going to win. And this is apparently evidence of an October surprise. And as you point out in the book, we've seen these from virtually every presidential candidate since. And this is, I think, a very significant connection that at least deserves, you know, deeper investigation to see to what extent Nixon and his allies were involved in the recruiting and manipulation of Sirhan Sirhan, essentially to be the Manchurian candidate or the dummy, the guy who could be set up and then sent to prison, the fall guy for this dastardly crime. And you don't draw specific conclusions in the book, but you raise enough questions to point the reader in this direction.
Yes. As a responsible journalist, I have never accused anybody of committing a crime unless I have all the evidence in my hand to present it in court. And that's the way it should be. You have to have the evidence in hand if you're accusing anybody of anything, whatever crime it is. So I don't have the evidence that, you know, who killed him. But I do have plenty of evidence that there was a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you read my book and you see the amount of people that saw the woman in the pocket dress, who was the woman who ran out saying, we shot him, we shot him. And when the Kennedy worker asked, who did you shoot? And she says, Kennedy, and keeps running into the darkness. Now, this woman becomes a mystery that the FBI, the police, the whole world is looking for 6 weeks. At the end of 6 weeks, they say she doesn't exist. Now, that's a pretty brazen move on the part of the police and the authorities. There were more than two dozen people who saw the woman in the polka dot dress with Sahan that night.
Well, and let
that
me...
That night, not in the previous few weeks, that night.
And let me point out that just the day before, your key witness, John Fahey, had taken the woman in the polka dot dress for a ride, and during this time, she's, you know, being very cryptic, saying, "I'm in trouble, but if I tell you, you'll get involved, and they'll come after you like they'll come after me." She was extremely conspiratorial, but she did clue him in that there was a plan to kill Bobby Kennedy. This is before the event.
She actually confessed to be part of it. Because in one of those little lines that she gave him, she says, "I belong to a group." She used those words.
Mm-hmm.
So she, at that very moment, she has confessed that she's a conspirator. Now, let me give you, this is very important. Let me give you my take on this woman. The reason why I think this woman did this, because a lot of people say, "Well, why would she run out saying we kill him, we kill him?" Well, should I remind people that terrorists love to advertise their kill? Do I have to tell people to watch a movie, like, for example, the rescue of Apollo, you know, the spacecraft, when we watched that movie, when Houston, when they splashed down, what did the people in Houston say? "We did it, we did it." That's part of the thing. The adrenaline is going. These people have been trained. They're committing the crime the moment they have completed. That's what happened. So it is not strange that she would run out saying, "We shot him, we shot him, or we shot Kennedy, we shot Kennedy." I don't find that unusual at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I'd like to delve into a little bit here is a stronger connection between the woman in the polka dot dress and Anna Chenault. And, Fernando, I'm a little younger than you. I kind of cut my teeth on the Watergate scandal as when I was a young radio talk show host in Chicago. And so I know quite a bit about Watergate, and I've, explored Anna Chenault in the past. What I don't find in your book is a strong connection between her and the so-called woman in the polka dot dress.
That's because the connection that exists is that the woman in the polka dot dress told Faye during the daytime, she released little pieces of information. One of those little pieces of information is the fact, or was the fact, that in coming through New York or through the East, she came through New York from Beirut or Aqaba. In coming through, she had met with Anna Chenault 3 days before the assassination. Now, in my book, as a journalist, as an investigator, if somebody tells me that, I'm up there, and I should know, questioning her, you know, for the next 20 hours. The police were told this, by the way. In the tape in which the police is interrogating John Fahey and really badgering him to change his story, in there, about 2 minutes into the tape, he says, he mentions it, he says, "She mentioned an acquaintance with Anna Chenault, clear as a bell. He told me, when I took him on his trip to reconstruct his trip with a woman in the polka dot dress, mm-hmm. when I took him on that trip, he told me, 'Fernando, in all this excitement and all these details, you know, I forgot to tell you that this woman said she knew Anna Chenault and had met with Anna Chenault 3 days before when she came through New York.'"
Mm-hmm.
So presumably the woman was in this country for no more than 3 days, presumably. And although, you know, a lot of people are saying, "Well, he was in with a beautiful woman. Well, there may have been other women, or she may have just come just for the killing."
Mm-hmm.
Point is that at this point, the only connection that we have with Anna Chenault and the Nixon campaign is that the woman herself said so.
Mm-hmm.
She told Fahey, and Fahey told the FBI, and Fahey told the police. So we have to assume this man is a chemical salesman. Yeah, Fahey, what I'm trying to do is Fahey is a regular individual. He's not an agent. He's not a policeman. He's not a spy. You know, this man is telling us his story, and he was scared stiff. He's telling us his story as he lived it. So I believe him.
And
when you check his story and you polygraph the man, and the man passes a polygraph given by the president of the American Polygraph Association, and he passes it with flying colors.
Mm-hmm.
Flying colors, he passed.
And you point out in the book that Fahey was somewhat compromised because he was a married man who took this hot babe out on a day trip. And then this became something that he got, embroiled in a police investigation. So it appears that the whole time he was probably worried that his wife was going to find out about this.
Now, this guy was worried from the beginning. This is really, you could almost make a comedy out of this if you wanted to, change the context of it. Because this poor guy, when she first said, they're going to take care of Kennedy tonight, when she first said that, and she shocked him with that. And he looked around, and there were people in the counter, and he said, look, we better move to a table. And she moved her to a table so that he can have breakfast and talk. Now, this guy has now got, she's got his attention. And now, as they're having breakfast, and she gives him more snippets of information, and finally she says, we're being watched. And he looks around, and they are being watched, and they were being followed later on when they left the hotel. Now, this guy scared stiff. And so what he did after breakfast, he said, look, I have a couple of clients, one in Ventura, one in Oxnard. I really have to go. I can't stay anymore. He was trying to leave. He was trying to get rid of her. She invited herself. She said, look, can I go with you? And he looked at the guy that was looking at them, and as a gentleman, he says, okay, you can go with me.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes it with her. So the whole thing appears to be an accident. And I believe that it was, because she was trying to bail out of a conspiracy in which she was over her head. This woman was only in her mid-20s. She cannot be an experienced field, CIA operator or terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
She's too young. And she was gorgeous. I mean, she didn't have, she was very feminine, very attractive. So this woman got over her head, and at the last minute realizes that they really mean it. They're going to do it today. And she tries to get a passport desperately from a salesman that she doesn't even know. She is just plain desperate.
Mm-hmm.
That is my take on this woman. It could be different, but that's my take on this one. This young woman got involved over her head. Now, listen, here's something else that is very important, and that is in the book, and very few people paid importance to it. The police questioned a group of friends of Sahan, which were hypnotizing Sahan and making him go crazy. They have that on their record. So he was a very easily hypnotizable subject. Was very susceptible because of the Rosicrucians.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, this woman that predicted the killing, the book of the woman, also said she had to stop at the Rosicrucian temple on the way to San Francisco to get on CAT airline. CAT airline is civil air transport, which has been owned 100% by the CIA since 1949.
And Fernando, I've been to the Rosicrucian temple in San Jose. And I am aware that hypnosis is a part of their practice, if you will. But you really added important dimensions to Rosicrucian beliefs and the way that Sirhan had investigated or explored being hypnotized and self-hypnosis, I suppose for self-improvement. But do you believe that that made him much more suggestible to a hypnotic event as he was, there at the ambassador and performed this hit?
Well, I was into self-hypnosis. Self-hypnosis is a wonderful thing. Hypnosis is a marvelous thing. When you use hypnosis, you can do a lot of things that you don't think you could do miraculously. Self-hypnosis is, to me, it's been like a bomb. And I learned to do it a long time ago, and I taught my children, how to calm down and so forth and so on. these people are experts. You know, the people that manipulated Sahan are experts. They probably surveil before they choose their target. And he had to be susceptible to hypnosis, which is very simple to determine. I can sit in front of you and say, somebody comes and tells me, hey, Fernando, why don't you go and find out, why don't you go and see how susceptible Peter is? And I say, okay, fine. So I go, I sit in front of you, and I cough. If you cough after me immediately, or you put your hand to your mouth, and you react to it physically, you are a very susceptible individual for hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So determining who is and who's not susceptible is very simple. You know, they do that in the theater all the time. Sirhan was obviously a very susceptible individual, and he practiced it voluntarily through the Rosicrucians before he was used, because according to Sirhan now, she was the trigger, and she did it by pinching him, which, by the way, coincides with what Vincent DiPiero. Vincent DiPiero was one of the kitchen workers, a student at UCLA, the son of the maitre d', and he was just about 4 feet from the woman and Sirhan. And he saw Sirhan smiling and talking to her. They were chatting together. Sirhan gives her a hand, and she puts her hand on his shoulder, and she's helping him down. At which time, he says she pinched him, and it hurt him in the shoulder. And he turned out and started shooting. It appears that that pinching was the trigger.
Mm-hmm. And Fernando, you also, throughout the book, describe two male accomplices who were at the ambassador with Sirhan that night and who were spotted by eyewitnesses lurking in a hallway waiting for Bobby Kennedy to leave the ballroom and exit through the kitchen. Did the FBI and the LAPD pursue those two male accomplices, and did they ever find them?
Well, let me... My category of response would be no, they didn't do it. But let me qualify that, because I don't know that we have access to all the police records. You know, they're supposed to turn all the records to the state of California, and that's where the researchers are getting some of the information. And I don't know if they have turned all of the records over. But in looking over what the state of California has that they turned over, those interviews and those records are not there. And to me, that's very important in the direction that we headed, to come up with witnesses. Oh, and by the way, these friends of Sirhan said that the boy that was hypnotizing him and turning him, you know, making him go crazy and stop him anytime he wanted him to, he said that they had indicated, or they had said, that they had plans to kill political figures. I mean, it's plural, more than one.
Well,
now, that is in the police record.
Right.
Why wasn't that followed? And if it was followed, why is it on the record for us to examine?
Mm-hmm. And what is your take on the prosecutor's case? The motive that they presented was that Sirhan was Palestinian, and he was really pissed at Bobby Kennedy for being pro-Israel, just to simplify it to the basics here. And that appears to be the basis of the motive that was presented by the prosecution in his trial.
That is the spin. That is the official spin they're giving it. And that's one of the reasons, one of the motivating forces behind me, you know, when I learned what was happening with Nixon and the Vietnam War, you know, the scuttling of the peace talks, I got so angry. You know, that was one of the things that pushed me forward to get back, get all my records back, get all my notes back, put it all together again, and publish the book, because it has historical significance. The fact that this may have been just the thinning of the herd, because Robert Kennedy was the only obstacle between the White House and Richard Nixon. At that time, he was the only obstacle. Hubert Humphrey was 23 points behind. He was no obstacle at all.
And Gene McCarthy fizzled out during the summer.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
And Humphrey was certain, even though he tried to shed the Vietnam War, he was still saddled with it.
Mm-hmm.
So the only wall between the White House and Richard Nixon was Robert Kennedy. In my estimation, in my heart of hearts, that is my belief. This was a conspiracy with the thinning of the herd to get the man to the White House. Now, was he involved in it? I don't know. Did he know about it? I don't know. Was this one of his group? Because the group that was trying cooperating to scuttle the Paris peace talks were five people. Three of them wound up in jail. Or two of them wound up in jail, one out of the White House. One of them was Mitchell. One of them was Agnew. One of them was John Tower, Texas.
The senator.
Mm-hmm. The senator. And Anna Chenault.
Mm-hmm.
Anna Chenault and John Tower were rumored to be lovers at the time, but that's neither here nor there. Point is, there's five people involved in trying to scuttle the Vietnam peace talks. Just a few weeks before, a few days before, Alexander Sachs of Goldman Sachs had a meeting with all the Wall Street people to determine how would this apply to the market, how would the market react if the war ended or it was shut down. Now just think of it. I mean, how is this going to affect the market? By the way, they're very close friends,
mm-hmm.
Nixon and Sen. So anyway, they had this meeting. Nixon, it is said that he really didn't succeed because the North Vietnamese were not ready to go to the table, to the negotiating table. So they say that he really did no damage, but he didn't know that. He had no way of knowing because he was trying very hard to scuttle the Paris peace talks.
Mm-hmm.
And the NSA picked up the transmission between Anna Chenault and the embassy in Saigon saying, don't do anything, hang on, we're going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I mean, all of these things appear to be very complicated, you know, but if you take one at a point, if you just take one point and examine that one till you get to the end, we could get some answers to this, to these horrible, political crimes.
And, Fernando, I want to say that there was an extraordinary hearing at the California Parole Board this past February, and a witness appeared. And I'll explain just a little bit for our listeners. California has a parole process where victims or victims' representatives are guaranteed an opportunity to speak and to object to a proposed parole for a certain prisoner. And so exercising that right, 91-year-old Paul Schrade, a former United Auto Workers officer, gave testimony at the parole hearing, where he described Sirhan Sirhan as a political prisoner and not only advocated for his release, but he said this, "I believe that the board should grant a parole in the name of Robert F. Kennedy and in the name of justice. I want you to know from me, Sirhan, that I forgive you for shooting me and that you did not shoot Robert Kennedy and you're being mistreated so long. And I should have been here long ago, and that's why I feel guilty of not being here to help you and help me understand what happened." Now, I should point out to our listeners that Sirhan Sirhan has consistently maintained that he has no memory of what occurred. He remembers being jostled and choked by the people who wrangled him to the ground, including former football player Rosie Greer. But he has no recollection, and he has it confounds the members of the parole board, but he has been saying that in one form or another for years. And Paul Schrade, based on evidence of 11 gunshots from an audio recording, not the 8 that were attributed to Sirhan, he says, well, that's evidence that there was a second shooter. And you point out in the book The embattled coroner of L.A. County, Tom Noguchi, explained that there was some unknown federal agent who came into the autopsy room, removed a bullet that he had pulled out of Bobby Kennedy, and then brought it back sometime later. So all of these raise significant questions about the official story. And when we couple that with your informed speculation about hypnosis and the Rosicrucian practices, when we look at the role of the woman in the polka dot dress, when we look at the amnesia reported by Sirhan Sirhan, all of these buttress the reporting that you have provided in your book, Fernando.
Thank you. It's a shame that we don't really have access to the records. You know, people like you and myself and the legitimate researchers, you know, we don't have access to these government records, because I feel, and I was talking to...
At this point, my phone connection with Fernando was interrupted, so I called him back, and he had this to say. Hi, Fernando.
The call, yeah, we lost it.
Yeah, the call dropped there. We can blame the NSA.
If you could, I haven't had one of these without some trouble.
I believe it. They're very active. We know that. I actually call my minder Freddie. Hey, Freddie, how you doing today?
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, at one time when they were following me home, you know, and my wife talked to me about it, she said, "My God," and I said, "Don't worry about it, honey. That's good. You know, that's the police. I'm the safest man in town. You know, there's nobody going to touch me while they're on my tail."
Yeah.
So.
Well, you were talking about how you're disappointed that we don't have access to the records, and you said, "I feel," and I was talking to, and then we got cut off.
Yeah, I feel that. This is the one of this political assassination. I believe that this is the one that could be resolved by doing what I call coming through the back door. I mean, we have sufficient information that we can go after that may still be available. And if we can identify the people around that original conspiracy to scuttle the peace talks, we will come up with the people that sponsored this woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's now, my feeling.
One area that you delved into...
How do you get all of those records?
Right. One area that you delved into was that the Watergate burglary by Nixon's so-called plumbers was an effort to find out if the Democratic National Committee and Larry O'Brien, its chairman, actually knew about Anna Chenault and a possible role of Nixon people in the RFK assassination.
You know, shortly during the Watergate break-in, Nixon was a very, very, very worried man. And the reason why he went along, I imagine he went along with this burglary, this butcher burglary, is because the man was really worried. All of these events have a connection. They have lines that lead one to the other. Now, I am convinced that Nixon wanted to know what the Democrats had on him regarding the scuttling of the peace talks and the killing of Robert Kennedy. Now, let me make clear now, because this is very important to me. My credibility is all I have. I am not accusing anybody of doing anything. The point is that we have all the indications and we have legitimate questions that we can raise of these people. We have the right to do it, and we should be doing it, but we're not doing it.
And Fernando, as I mentioned, I went deep into the Watergate case at the time, and I've followed it. I've been to listen to some of the Oval Office recordings that have been maintained. And I never was comfortable with the story we were told, that the motive for the DNC break-in was to discover whether the Democrats had found out about the illegal campaign contributions that had been made by Howard Hughes. And I always thought that was a pretty weak argument. It never really convinced me. And I have to say that the theory you advance here, that it was to discover if there was knowledge of the RFK assassination, carries much more water than the idea that they were concerned about campaign contributions from Howard Hughes.
Oh, this campaign contribution power is baloney. Now, I was the press director for Hubert Humphrey during the campaign in '68, in the early part of the, right after the campaign. And I was in Houston. You know, I traveled with the family as an advanced man also. While I was in Houston, which by coincidence, our campaign ran into the Nixon campaign, simultaneously. But anyway, I was told that night when we landed in Houston, I was there and I was having a fight of my life because Wall Street has sent a lawyer down to Houston for a $25,000 a plate dinner at the Petroleum Club. And again, you know, being the dummy that I am, I said, wait a minute, the Petroleum Club, those guys are all multimillionaires. They're all Republicans. There isn't one vote in there for us. What are we doing there? He says, simple, $25,000 a plate, gold plate dinner, raising funds for a speech for Humphrey, and we need the money. So here we are on the enemy's camp asking him for money. Now, and that's why I say that in Dallas, you know, in Houston, I lost my political virginity because that's when I learned that Howard Hughes had contributed $500,000 to our campaign and $500,000 to the Nixon campaign. And that's how, quote, access, end quote, is done in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So why vote? Both horses are owned by the same owner. I mean, anybody that raises that question, everybody will say, oh, it's better to know. You've got to vote. Okay, fine, but give me a choice. I'm voting for two horses, and they're the same owner.
Mm-hmm.
So, and unfortunately, that's the way. And when I came back, you know, everybody was talking. I said, well, if Humphrey makes it, you know, maybe you'll wind up in the press office in the White House. I said, look, I want no part of this. When this is over, and I was at Hubert Humphrey's kitchen the night of the election. We were only 3 points behind at that point. It was a very emotional night. The Secret Service was all over the place trying to establish communications and so forth because it was that close. If you remember, it was only 3 points difference.
Right.
And I was there in the kitchen, and I told them all, you know, I was there with a couple of my staff and a couple of other people. They said, you're staying? I said, no. I don't like any of this. I'm going back home to the job I like, and that's going after the bad guys. So, well, then the election was over. I went right back to my job.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fascinating book, The Polka Dot File, on the Robert F. Kennedy killing. And it has a little sub-bar here, Paris Peace Talks connection. That's what we've been discussing. And, Fernando, before we wrap up, I just want to ask you an open-ended question. Is there anything that I didn't cover that you think is significant that you want to share with my listeners?
Not really. You've done a good job. And in talking to Julia this morning, the daughter of my publisher, she said something that told me something about you.
Uh-oh.
She said that you had insisted on reading the book before commenting on the air about it or saying anything about it. And I have to congratulate you because I believe that's the way it should be. That's the way, if you're going to be a responsible journalist, you have to do it that way. You can't just go making comments and talking without knowing what you're talking about. When she told me that you had requested the book so you could read the book and have some pertinent questions, my respect for you went very high.
Well, I'm sorry to say that I'm a dinosaur in that respect. If you watch the morning TV shows in particular, they'll bring an author on there, and Matt Lauer has never even seen the book. He's fed a list of questions by a producer who may or may not have read the book. And, you know, that's what passes for journalism and media reporting these days. But with some exceptions, there are a few times when I've interviewed an author before I could get a hold of a book. But if the book is published, I insist on reading it before I talk to the author. I just think that it's a fundamental respect to you for all the work that you've put in. And it's also, you know, I don't like to be ignorant of what's in the book and just ask general questions. So thank you for that comment, Fernando. I do appreciate
it. You're a real pro.
All right. Well, thanks again for your book. Pleasure spending time with you today. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to my in-depth interview with Fernando Faura. And yes, I did read the book. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.